Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Hello, and welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. It's aerial imagery today. Specifically, we will be talking about Historic England and how they use aerial imagery in their work. With me to discuss this is Katie Whittaker. Hi there, Katie. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing really well, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Brilliant. Welcome to the podcast. As we always do, could you maybe start with introducing yourself to the listeners?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm Dr. Katie Whittaker, and I'm an archaeologist who specialises in aerial survey. I've worked with aerial photographs for nearly 30 years. I started off in what is now Historic England Archive, which is responsible for England's National Library of Aerial Photographs. So there's more than 6 million aerial photographs in the collections. Wow. So I started working there, worked on various projects. We did a big National Lottery Heritage Fund project with one of our collections, the Aerofilms collection, which produced the Britain From Above website that some people might know. Then Historic England is a big organisation. I've worked in different teams, and then a few years ago moved into the research department and specifically the aerial survey team. Which is that's what I'm doing now with my our whole team of people dedicated to aerial survey.
Oh, that's really cool. So, would you say that being an archaeologist who then looks at aerial imagery is sort of like a normal career path, or are there people who are sort of remote sensing people who've gone, oh, you know what, I don't want to just look at data formats all day long. I want to actually have an application, and then they've gone into archaeology. Or do you get a mix?
Yeah, no, I think a mix. It's more likely to start out in archaeology and then specialise into the way that remote sensing is used in archaeology, which includes aerial photography and other remotely sensed data. Okay. Principally, for the UK, that is principally aerial photography and LIDAR. It's different in other countries where there's been a different history of legislation about taking photographs from the air. So in the UK, it's almost always been possible to take photographs from an aeroplane. There are some restrictions, or there have been some restrictions in the past, but it means we've got 100 years worth of aerial photography in Britain. Whereas if you're in Italy or Hungary, for example, there was legislation until really very recently that made it illegal to take photographs from the air. So there's other sources that are used a bit more in other countries. In the UK, very much the focus is on aerial photography and more recently LIDAR data sets, because we have that great history.
That's really cool to know, because I've had conversations in the past, particularly recently as satellites become more and more sort of high spatial resolution, and people are going, oh, it's got to be illegal to look in my back garden or whatever it is, so, sort of using those high resolution stuff. But no, and we could even fly an aircraft over it. Thank you very much.
Yes, exactly that. And you mentioned high resolution satellite. We are starting to experiment with that. Okay. At Historic England a little bit. We're just about to introduce some through our partnership in the Earth Observation Group. Do an experiment with on our current project of ours, but really, for archaeological purposes, where you might be looking at something really small, a feature that's just a few metres in size, you can see how aerial photography taken from an aircraft is going to have benefits compared with imagery that's captured from geospatial orbits, or you know, it's a different question of scale and.
Definitely. I'm sure we'll get into that as well. So maybe could you say a bit more about Historic England and the sort of aerial investigation and mapping team? You've introduced them, but sort of maybe sort of round it out a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. So to use the jargon, Historic England is the UK government's advisor on the historic environment. So what that means is we're interested in archaeology, buildings and places. And then an organisation like Natural England, you can imagine being interested in habitat and ecology. What we're looking at is archaeology, buildings and places, and how people manage archaeological features on land that they own, or how they care for their historic buildings, which could include your house, if your house is sort of 100, 150 or a couple of hundred years old. And we're there to provide advice for people. And to advise the government about what should be protected, how to protect it, how we can look after these really important aspects of our environment. So the organisation as a whole has got a really wide remit, but we have a research department, because it's important that we support or underpin the advice and the guidance and the training that we do with carefully researched data, with good quality data, and that we're looking at innovations, what's coming next, what do we need to bring into the way that we do things. So we have a research department, an aerial survey is part of that. Okay. The aerial investigation and mapping team, that describes our whole team, we use all the available aerial sources that we can access to research. It might be a small area, a specific archaeological monument, if that's required, or to do big area projects. We might cover a whole district or even a whole county and use all those aerial sources to map all the archaeological features that are visible on those aerial photographs from the 1920s onwards, then introducing more recent LIDAR data and anything else that we can access to bring to that. We develop methods and standards for the heritage sector in doing aerial survey work. We output new maps, new aerial photography. We take photographs as well. Lots of research reports, lots of guidance documents, and training that people can do online. We also do in-person training sessions. And that could be everything from local groups, local archaeological and history societies who want to learn more about how to use aerial photographs or how to work with LIDAR for archaeological research, through to students, university students. We do some coursework for people. And activity days and workshops and stuff like that. We get involved in lots of different ways.
Oh, cool. So given that, I was going to say, given that archaeology has been around for so long, well, I guess it hasn't actually. It's only been around a couple of hundred years, sort of in a scientific way. Is there much more to map? I guess we've been looking at things for a long time, but are you still finding quite a lot of interesting things in the data that you collect?
Yes. Yeah. There's two sides to answer that question. One is, if we think about the country as a whole, so Historic England works in England. Like I mentioned, we have partner organisations in Wales and Scotland. And some years ago in England, we started a thing called the National Mapping Programme. And the idea was that we would be able to map the whole of the country, or the archaeological features for the whole of the country. And we have got quite a long way there, but there are still some pretty big gaps, because that is an ambitious project. And so now we do a mix. We focus on particular areas or particular sites if there's a threat or a problem or something we need to understand, or we do large areas. And I've just finished with a colleague working on the northeast corner of Kent, the district of Thanet. So we've covered quite a big area there,
right?
Making new maps. And one of the reasons for going to the Isle of Thanet, the northeast corner of Kent, in southeast England, is there's going to be lots of development there. There's been new road schemes, there's planned new road schemes, there's likely to be some big housing developments. And so the local authority, Kent County Council, Thanet District Council, they want better information about the archaeology that's there. So we've gone back, and I say gone back because the County of Kent was the pilot project for the National Mapping Programme when it started back in the 1980s. So it was mapped in the 1980s. This was when the mapping was done by hand. There was sketch plotting. We didn't have the same kind of digital control of the imagery, rectification, the actual spatial sort of accuracy and precision was not there. And the remit of the project was a lot smaller than today. Mostly they were looking for prehistoric and Roman archaeological features. Now we record everything that we can see from prehistory up to the Cold War, because it's all part of that beautiful, fascinating mix of what makes places look the way they look today. We've gone back to that area, and it was a fantastic piece of work. And yes, it really did involve finding new things and mapping things that hadn't been recorded before. And in fact, we made records for more than 2,500 archaeological monuments in the end, for a 162 square kilometre area. That goes to show how much is actually out there.
Yes. Okay. I stand corrected. that is really, really impressive. You've mentioned the size of the archive that you have in terms of aerial imagery. Could you comment maybe on how important it is to try and maintain that, and how long you might want to maintain it?
Yes, it really is important to maintain archive collections and archive data sets, and for as long as possible, which I'm sure, as you can imagine, brings its challenges. This project on the Isle of Thanet, northeast Kent. I've mentioned this before. If you're looking, you're trying to create as complete a record as possible. If you want to understand what an area was like in the Bronze Age, for example, you can't. It's no good saying, "Well, there's a housing estate over there now, and we can't see anything about that." Those houses were built in the 1960s or the 1970s. If you've got aerial photographs from the 1950s that show crop marks in the field, then of course you're going to want that information. We want to be able to look at everything possible, because we want to be able to fill those gaps. We might be doing a research project for other reasons. We might want to understand vegetation change in an area, in which case, again, you want to go back to the earliest possible imagery and look at whatever's available in all those different steps and see how vegetation on a moor has changed, for example. Has it grown up? Is it obscuring archaeological monuments that are on the surface? Or the opposite, is it dying back? Are we losing vegetation? What's happening to the peat, for example, as it shrinks? How's that affecting what's there on the surface? So you need that time depth to be able to try to understand the story of what's happening before you can make decisions about what to do today to look after these places or to investigate them. Maybe it is important to go in and do an excavation, because new houses are going to be built. So to make decisions, we need to look at everything possible. And then you might have a specific research question. You might be mapping military archaeology, for example, First World War and Second World War features. And because there's lots of 1940s Royal Air Force coverage of the country, we can get a lot of detail, things that were only there for a few months or for a couple of years while the Second World War was happening, for example, and then were cleared away very quickly. If we don't get the information off those old photographs, we don't have it. So you might be able to say, well, we know there was a military airfield in a particular location, but what we don't know is where all the pillboxes around its perimeter were, we might know where its main bomb storage site was, but where were the ancillary stores? Where were the out stations? Where were all those other features, the radio direction finding installations and everything else? So yeah, we want to be able to look as much as possible to get the whole picture. But yeah, it does mean you need a lot of storage space. Yes. Because all this historical material is actual photographic prints and actual film. If you imagine a film canister like you used to put in the back of your camera, 35mm film, but scale that up so that you're looking at a film canister that's 8, 10 or 12 inches tall, and like a great big roll that you can hardly get your hands around. That's the kind of film we're talking about. It all needs a home. And then the same thing with now digital data. So we started taking digital photographs in the early 2000s. We only take capture digital photography now. That all needs its own kind of storage and a long-term future to be able to go back and reuse and reuse that imagery and use it for different things, use it for new things as well.
Yeah. And I'm guessing the whole of the old archive has been digitized so that you can use it, or is there still bits that you want to go and sort of poke around in the cupboard and see what you got, sort of thing?
Yeah, it by no means has it all been digitized, no. But we're working towards that. Sometimes it's possible to put funding packages together to have specific programs. I mentioned just earlier the Aerofilms collection and the Britain From Above project. This is all about aerial photography. Aerofilms Limited were a company that started business in 1919 and they closed in 2008. So that's a lot of aerial photography. Yeah. And we were able, with National Lottery Heritage Fund money a few years ago, to conserve, because this is the other thing, working with old material, you have to prepare it first of all. So to conserve, digitize, catalogue, you've got to be able to say where things are so people can find what they're after, and then put online the first approximately 10% of that collection. So we're talking about a collection that's 1.2 million images in size, and we were able to put together a project which took 4 years to work with the images from 1919 to 1953.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, there's still a lot to be done.
Yes, yeah. So given that there's so many aerial photos taken at so many different time slices throughout the past 100+ years, do you find that you still have the same problem that most of us have, which is you have a site and you find out that all your data is just about 10 meters off to the wrong side of the site? Or is it fairly good coverage at certain like time slices? So maybe the First World War, somewhere in between the first and the second, and then maybe in the 50s or 60s. Are there certain dates where you go, oh, I know there's going to be good good England coverage for that?
Yes, there will be coverage.
Right.
But you're right. When we're doing our aerial investigation and mapping project, we know that there will be really good coverage for the 1940s, in particular between 1945 and 1950, because there were programs to fly the country. Government ministries wanted information about what the country was like at the end of the Second World War to be able to make plans for the future. So we know that the later 1940s Royal Air Force cover will be very good. It continues into the 1950s and 1960s. From the late 1960s and the 1970s onwards, then we start to pick up Ordnance Survey photography, which right. we're responsible for looking after. And also around about that time, commercial aerial photography starts. So that's a bit more patchy. It's commercial. They're taking the photographs for specific jobs. But yes, it may well mean that when we're researching a particular area, that there's good coverage because there's been some commercial photography too. And then our own photography. So we have two members of staff who are responsible for reconnaissance, one for the north of England and one for the south. And we started taking our own photographs from, again, the 1960s. And then depending on particular research questions or where we knew there were gaps around the country, there'll be more or less of our own photography at different times. We know that crop marks form really well over gravels, for example.
Okay.
So earlier on in our own reconnaissance programs, there'll be lots of photography of areas like the Thames Valley, areas where crop marks show really well. On the chalk, on chalk geology, crop marks are usually really good as well. So Wiltshire and Dorset, the South Downs and the North Downs, the Yorkshire chalk and the Yorkshire Wolds. But as we've learned, that archaeological features also show in different kinds of soils and different geology. As long as the conditions are right, you then start to get more photography of the fenland, areas on clays as well. And then, of course, the upland in Cornwall and Devon, or up in Cumbria, for example, lots of archaeology is actually just on the surface and really visible because it's prehistoric roundhouses built of stone boulders, for example. Yeah. Whole settlements built in stone that, yes, of course, they're ruinous. And if you wanted to learn more about them, you would maybe need to do some excavation. But brilliant to get aerial photography into these remote places. You can cover so many sites in a day if the flying conditions are good, and
true,
capture
yes.
photographs, which by foot on the ground would take you weeks and weeks to cover and to survey. So aerial photography is really important for those kind of sites too.
Oh, that's really cool. So you've said a bit about what you're trying to capture and why, and sort of the size of the archive that you have. Maybe you could introduce us to the Aerial Photo Explorer and a way of sort of disseminating that information.
Yes, so this is something we set up quite recently, a few years ago. The Historic England Air Photo Explorer is a map-based website, so people can go look for areas they're interested in and see if there's photography online from our collections. So it's newly taken photographs, because they will be born digital, and then scanned imagery. So the newly taken photographs will almost always be oblique aerial photographs, so taken from an aircraft looking down at the ground at a bit of an angle. We do have camera pods on the aircraft, so we do take overlapping vertical sets of photographs as well to cover areas. That's usually project-based, so it's a bit more limited, the coverage available for that. And then all of those old photographs, all of that historic material, as and when it gets scanned, those scans become available and can go onto the Airphoto Explorer. So there's about 550,000 images on there. It's only a proportion of what's in the archive, and we work closely with our archive colleagues
to make this
work. It's
still massive, though.
We're really proud of it. I mean, it is a great resource. It's really great to be able to go online, look at a map, zoom into it, just like you would on Google Maps. You know, you can look at this on your phone. Just zoom in the way that you're used to. See either the dots on the maps for the oblique aerial photographs, or a square or a rectangular footprint for a vertical aerial photograph, and then click on that symbol and you'll get a little thumbnail. You can click on the thumbnail to look at the bigger image. It will give you the date of the photograph, a bit of information about it, and then ways that you can share that photograph or make use of it. Or if you want a proper copy, either for your own research or for something that a piece of work that you're doing, you can put an order in as well. So 550,000 is pretty good. And then periodically we upload more photos, new photos newly taken, or older photos that have been scanned and prepared and are available to go online. Yeah, so that's one of our main websites.
And is there a driver for having created that? Was it to try and get people to understand the type of work that you're doing and the utility of aerial photography in archaeology and for like other types of mapping? Or was it to try and get people to understand the data and then come to you and go like, hey, we've just bought one of your images and done this cool thing on it? Because, I mean, we're all scientists. We all love to hear about other people's cool stuff. Or is it just a sort of like, hey, we're an organization that really is into making data available? Like, what's the motivation behind it?
It's all of those things.
Okay.
It is all of those things. But in particular, it's that last one. It's making this stuff available. We're a government-funded organization. It's taxpayers' money that pays for us. And we're there to provide advice, guidance and training, but we're responsible for looking after these collections, and it's really important to try to find ways to make it easier for people to access them. So for the images themselves, that's the Airphoto Explorer. For the archaeological maps that we make, that's our Aerial Archaeology Mapping Explorer, where rather than the raw photograph, which you can look at and make up your own mind of what you can see in it, or maybe the thing you want to learn about is not the thing that I'm interested in. Perhaps you're interested in, you know, you can use the photographs for all sorts of other things as well, like looking at tree cover and thinking about ecological problems, you know, not just archaeology. But because we also make archaeological maps, we make sure that data is then available through the Mapping Explorer, so people can look at actually what it is that we've recorded, can click on archaeological features on that map, and up pops information that says, this is a ring ditch, we think it's Bronze Age. Here is a link to a text record that will tell you more about that and give you published sources where you can go and read about it, because 30 years ago it was excavated and there's an excavation report, that sort of thing. So both those websites, the Airphoto Explorer and the Aerial Archaeology Mapping Explorer, are about trying to find ways to make what we do more accessible for all those people out there that it's meant to be for.
Yeah. I guess as well with climate change, or the impacts of climate change, particularly around like coastal communities and things like that, the fact that you're collecting information I'm guessing right up to the coastal margin in terms of what may or may not have been there, is going to be really key and critical, not only for what happens in the future to those communities, but also you've got a record of what was there, and something might pop out of the cliff, as it were, when the cliff starts to erode more, that at least you're aware of, and you can say, okay, well, either we can try and protect it, or we can try and make people aware so that there's this important structure that's there. And without the knowledge, without having mapped it already, then like, we're just sort of blindly wandering into the future. So yeah, I can definitely see how this is a useful archive.
Yeah, and that you mentioning the coastal erosion problem is really pertinent. We map up to the coastal edge. If we can rectify the imagery, if the imagery is accurately, or we can accurately spatially reference the imagery, we'll map onto the beach and into that coastal zone, right. Because there are things like medieval fish traps, or you know, other features, other structures that are sort of just there in that coastal zone. And yeah, we have to make decisions now, and we're going to have to make decisions in the future about what can be kept, what might be given up. They're really difficult decisions. This is a topic that Historic England really is grappling with our colleagues who work on climate change topics. And if we can provide that evidence and the record, then it makes it, hopefully it makes it not necessarily easier, but certainly local communities and the people who are affected directly by these things can make decisions together more effectively about what they can do, about what can happen. It's sad to say, but even if the record that we're taking with our own photographer, for example, looking at the east coast of Yorkshire, there are cliff falls every year, and we have photographs that show Second World War features on the top of the cliff, and then on the edge of the cliff, and then halfway down the cliff, wow. And then on the beach, okay. As time has progressed over the years. It's sad to say, but that's also what's happening, and our photography is part of a record of that.
Yeah, and that's really critical. I'm guessing as well that dry and sort of drought summers like we had last year in 2025, they're helpful for, well, I'm naively going to suggest that they're helpful for finding details in the aerial photography. Is that the case?
Yes, it is. Archaeological features will show as crop marks, and that's because of the different amount of moisture that is available to plants to grow. Right. And that's affected by what's in the soils, what's buried. So yeah, I mentioned we have a flying program with two colleagues covering the north and the south of the country. They are looking for new finds. They are looking for crop marks that may well not have shown before, but that do because there's a particular drought year. So that is an important part of what they do. But they're also monitoring known sites. They're looking at the condition of known sites. They're contributing to specific research projects with new photography. They're getting data that's relevant to those issues, like climate change, like coastal erosion. That the flying program is a really important part of always adding to what will become the archive of the future.
Yeah, right. Hi, it's a real shame that we're coming up to the end of our time, but it's been really fascinating. I love it when I find teams of people doing Earth observation and remote sensing that I hadn't really sort of interacted with beforehand. It's been brilliant talking to you and finding out more about that. If our listeners want to know more, how best can they get in touch with you or the wider team?
I think the best thing to do as a start would be to look at the Historic England website and go to the research themed pages. It's really extensive. It covers more than just aerial survey, because our research teams do different sorts of work. But it does mean that there are a whole series of pages to do with aerial survey, our projects, the guidance, the training documents that we publish, like guidance and training on how to use LIDAR for archaeological research. That's a great starting point if that's the kind of thing that you're interested in getting into. It's also where our database of all our research reports lives. There are more than 7,000 research reports. They're not all authored by the aerial survey team, but all of the aerial survey research reports are there. So if you're looking for a particular area, or you want to learn more about how we do the work we do, you can do no better than to read a recent research report. That will give you that information. There's also our regular research magazine that you can sign up for. It's a PDF that will land in your inbox. And then there are contact details. So there are contact details if you're interested in a specific theme, or if you're interested in a particular area, for example, you've read one of those research reports, then the author names and their contact details will be on that report. You can get in touch.
That's really cool. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Katie, for coming on and telling us all about this. I'm going to go and play around with the web tools and see what I can find. It's brilliant.
Well, thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.